My name is Raymond Laflamme. And I assume you know that you're in the quantum information course. And if you speak French or you have a tendency of having a good French accent, you can say Raymond, or if it's too hard, you can call me Ray. And that works. So most people call me Ray, so you don't have to feel out of context. So during these lectures, I'm going to talk. Here's the rough plan. So it's the first time I teach this course. So things will have to be adjusted a little bit in different ways here and there. But in the first week, it'll be kind of stuff related to fundamentals, kind of basic ideas of quantum information, and I'll talk about some implementations. And when we talk about implementation, there's many of them. I'll talk about the ones that I know the most, which is optics and NMR, and they're very complementary in different ways. So, but if you have interest on other things, I can adapt here and there on different things. On the second week, we'll talk a little bit about computational complexity. And the goal here is to really understand, and I think quite often physicists have a different notion of efficiency than what computer scientists have, or a different notion of difficulty than what the computer scientists have. If you go in a lab and you ask somebody, how many qubits do you have? And you ask them to do something with 20 qubits, they'll say, it's incredibly hard. It's really hard. We cannot do something with 20 qubits today. The computer scientist says, as long as you try to solve problem and the amount of resources is polynomial, the number of qubits, that's easy. So the notion of hard and easy changes a little bit. And if you want to really understand why quantum information is interesting, a little bit of computational complexity is interesting, of what, how does it fit? And the impact of what quantum information is in computer science is quite interesting. So I'll mention a little bit about this. And then we'll talk about some algorithms where there is a reason of why we would be interested to use quantum mechanics to manipulate information. And on the third week, we'll talk a little bit about open quantum systems, about quantum error correction, and if I have time, private quantum channel. So that's what I have in mind for the 3 weeks. And if there's a subject that you really, that you get together and say, we really want to learn about something, if I know something about it, then we can kind of do something and adapt to probably the last few lectures and kind of do something related to it. Some references, I'm going to give some in some of the lectures and say, okay, in here, go and read this paper or go and read this if you want to learn more or if you want more details. But here's some general reference. There's a book by Nielsen and Chuang, and it's about 10 years old, and it's probably considered the Bible. Kind of everybody who goes and take a graduate course or a graduate studies in quantum information will read this or part of it here and there. There's a book by a student, Philip Kay, my colleague Mike Muska, and myself called Quantum Information, and I gave to Aggie a couple of copies of that book. And on algorithm stuff, which is a little bit more computer science oriented, because Kay and Muska are mathematicians, then you'll get a good explanation of things in there to complement. There's also some notes by John Preskill on his website, where you can get things which are sometimes explained complementary to what I'm going to do, and so you learn about that. Okay. So let's start first about fundamental. And what first piece I want to mention today, or kind of that you have to learn about, is why are we interested in quantum information. So if I ask you this question to you, what would you say? So you came to this course. You're not totally sure what you're getting into. Why did you come to this course? Total silence. This is not going to work for 3 weeks, I can tell you. I'm not going to do all the work on the side. So nobody knows any reason of why you come here. You guys have nothing else to do on a Monday morning at 11:30. Try something. The coffee was cold. You mistake. You got in the door. You've heard about it.
I'm paid to do it.
Okay. Why should we be interested in quantum information? So you can say this. It's going to kind of thaw the room a little bit. But I expect you guys to interact a little bit more. And in fact, I'm going to do something. Because there are people hiding at the back, and they kind of, when I ask a question like this, they're exactly doing this, dodging behind the computer. I'm going to close the last two rows for the next lecture so that you guys are a little bit nearer. So,
there's this practical application to speed up some algorithms using quantum information.
Exactly. For some algorithms, some problems, it seems that quantum information or quantum computers seems to be more efficient. And if I go back, in fact, so that's a good reason, but I thought that you guys would be not as forward in this. I would say, I'm going to tell you why I got interested. I was just curious. And I assume part of you are a bit curious also of this, the reason why you're coming here. You'll learn a little bit about something. And I'll say this is not that different from anything that you're going to learn. We're all curious. We're all curious about things. And in fact, to me, my curiosity is one of my challenges. And I'm too curious about so many things. And I'm happy now that we go less and less in the library because I always get distracted going to the library because I pick up a book and I start to read and then suddenly it's 6:30 and I haven't gone through to get the book that I have. But then I'm going to ask you a question. Being curious, I started to ask myself, why are we curious? And one day you'll have kids and you realize that there is an infinite regression of why when it comes. And maybe this came when my kids were small and I said, okay, I have to do the same thing thinking that I'm still young. But then I started to think, I think it's, we are curious, at least one way I rationalize it is that we are, it's Darwin's principle in the working. Because humans and people like you and me who are scientists are realized that we can focus our curiosity on trying to understand the world around us. And one of the totally amazing things is that if you do this, there is a piece of the world that we can understand. We can definitely not understand everything, but there's pieces that we seem to understand incredibly well. We know that when we heat up water, it's going to boil at a temperature. We can know that if you put things together and we call this a car, we can go from one place to the other. We can have things which flies. And I don't know if you're like me, but although I know the laws of physics which allows plane to fly, every time I get an airplane and I'm on the runway, I'm looking at this big piece of metal kind of chugging along, and it takes off. I probably was the only one who kind of worries that much. The physicists were supposed to understand. But there are pieces of the world that we can understand. And it doesn't stop this. When we really understand something, when we have a theory for something, we can predict things. Not only we can say, yes, these are behaving in this way, and we know that if the situation happens again, it'll do the same. But we can use these rules that we have learned and being predicting something which is outside what we've seen in our experiment. LHC and looking at the Higgs boson is one of these predictions. And suddenly, many of these predictions, by the way, fail. Quite often we see only the one that succeed, like the LHE, but some other prediction fails, and then we learn that the theory was wrong, and then we go back to the understanding. But some of them work. And when we understand how to predict things, we understand how to control them. And we can understand to control them, we develop some technologies which can help us on certain tasks, of doing certain things that we would have done by hand or in other means, and suddenly we find more efficient way of doing things. And there's two output of having technologies. One is sometimes they have societal impact, and sometimes they give us a set of new tools which allows us to push our curiosity on the different scale, either the smaller one, the larger one. And then you have this circle that comes in again and again. And sometimes I hear of people, and you might have known if you went to check my background, that I did a PhD in quantum cosmology, which is not exactly the most practical and application-driven field of science. And what I was focusing is really in this part here, and maybe kind of trying carefully to make some prediction. And the work I've done more recently, I realized that, yeah, this is a continuum of this. And there's nothing which contradicts of understanding fundamental piece of physics to kind of try to use it. And you don't need you as one scientist to do the whole circle. Some people just kind of get there and they're very happy. Some people kind of are happy there. There are people who move a little bit there. And there are people who do the control that are not really that careful about it or don't care as much about the understanding. But this is a way of how I understand science. Example of this, 20,000 years ago, there was this thing called lightning and forest fires, and kind of a few bold, crazy humans kind of decided to get nearer to this forest fires. They started to understand that fire could be controlled. If you put it between rocks, you can kind of suddenly take care of it and be sure that it doesn't kind of get unruly and do things, bad things is there. But once you have it, you can use it to melt metal. If you use it to melt metals, you'll be able to build tools to do different things. And one of them would be agriculture. And 20,000 years ago, human beings suddenly used these tools to do agriculture, which allowed to make food, which lasts longer than if you go hunting. If you go hunting, food doesn't last that long. But with vegetables, you can live a little bit. So there's a few people who could take a break of going hunting every morning. They could go in hunting only 2 days, every 2 days instead of one. So here's an example of that cycle, which had an incredible societal impact, because before people were nomads, and then suddenly they could gather in small groups. So that was 20,000 years ago. I can give you an example of 300 years ago with steam. Now, I won't go around all the details, but steam led to the industrial revolution, instead of having villages, having cities. And so I can do the same thing again with electromagnetism, which led to all these kind of information technologies that you guys have here on your desk. And then suddenly we don't have to go and look at things which are related to just cities. We suddenly be in touch with anybody around the world just by kind of using our fingerprints and our thumbs and kind of punching little things on this device. So again, incredible societal impact, and also new tools and technology to go in and involve things. Everything I've said up to now was in the past, and one of the reasons of doing quantum information is because 100 years ago, we discovered that the classical laws of physics are only an approximation which fails for a certain part of the world around us. And then we discovered quantum mechanics, and for the last 100 years, we've learned how to understand it. We've developed some technology which uses a little small part of quantum mechanics, like the laser, MRIs, or the transistor. But we've developed some technology. But in the last 25 to 30 years, we've learned that if we can manipulate information with the rules of quantum mechanics, we can do things that seems to be impossible or very hard with classical computing. So, this is the motivation, or at least this is my motivation, of why I am interested in quantum information. And one of the great things is that it's a field which is very young, which allows you to, if you're interested in the understanding part, and then I'll mention a few things during the lectures of the many pieces of quantum information science that we still don't understand, or we can use to check things about quantum mechanics. We can learn about how to control, and the quantum error question part is one theory which tells us how to control quantum systems. And then there's technologies that are coming, like quantum computers or quantum key distribution system or quantum sensors, and I hope I'll mention a little bit about it. What is the societal impact today of quantum information? Very little, but at some point when we talk about Shor's algorithm, I'll give you an example. In fact, we can see a little kind of, I'll call them green shoot of societal impact of the work that we do. So this is why I'm interested. So this is an attempt to answer the question of why. And really, it's based on curiosity. And here's the motivation of one person of why he was interested in quantum information. So that's Richard Feynman. So in the around 1980s, he got interested about quantum information, and he's going to say in this little slide why he is doing it.
That are produced by the laws of physics. There are some obvious ones, that because signals can only go at the speed of light, the computers, if they're too large in size, can't send signals back and forth across the computer in infinitesimal time, because there's a limit to the speed of light, that there's faster signals that you can transmit. There are also some questions about the minimum heat energy that can be generated by computers. One of the present-day problems of complicated computers is when they're doing fast computations, they generate a lot of heat. And the question is, do they have to? And what is the minimum amount of heat that they have to generate? This was a question described by Bennett and solved by him. And a lot of the work that I'm doing is closely related or was inspired by questions that he asked me, which was, on top of that, are there any limitations due to quantum mechanics? That is, if the computers that we use, that we build now are, you all think, very small, but I think are enormous. There are at least 10 to the 11 atoms in each transistor. And I don't want to have 10 to the 11 atoms in each transistor. 3 atoms should be enough. And therefore, we would be using not the classical approximation to the laws of physics, but the quantum mechanical approximations to the laws of physics. And an interesting question comes up as to whether if the system is so small, if you make a computer so small that its atomic size practically, we'll describe that more precisely soon, will we have some limitation because the laws of physics are altered?
It's very tempting to let him go and then my hour would go away. Margaret, thank you. So a couple of comments on Feynman's lecture. First, do you know why he mentioned that he didn't need 10 to the 11 atoms, but 3 would be okay? So he was influenced by classical computing, where the basic unit or operation is done by a transistor. And to do a transistor, you need 3 pieces, that 3 input, if you want to do reversible classical computing, and we'll come back to this. So there, Feynman made mistakes. We know today that we can do it with 2. And so 3, 2, 2. The second thing which I thought was really neat when I first heard this is that Feynman talks about the classical approximation to the laws of physics, and he talks about the quantum there is a better approximation, the quantum laws of physics. He's really thinking about what we know as approximation to the laws of physics, which, to me, when I listen to this, it ring a bell that what we do is only kind of understanding this approximation, and kind of, I believe there'll be something more fundamental at some point, which I hope you will discover and you will be able to explain to me in some years to come. Okay, so what is quantum information? So quantum information science is the science that tries to understand the implication of quantum mechanics for information processing. So in many ways, this is what we're going to do. We have the classical laws of physics. We'll explain a little bit how we frame them in the science, if you think about information processing. And then we'll compare what happens when you change the rules. And there's two things that can happen in principle when you change a rule. Things go worse or things go better. And then I'll tell you there's a bit of both. There are things that goes better because there are things in theory that we can do which are much, much more efficient. And there are things on the communication side that we can show that is impossible to do classically, but we can do quantumically. But the things which get worse, that when you try to get systems which are behaving quantum mechanically, it's very hard to have them and scale them up to get them large enough. And this is what a quantum computer would be, a kind of some form of semi-macroscopic machine which behaves quantum mechanically. And we've learned from quantum information science and the foundations of quantum mechanics that if systems are not very well insulated from their surrounding, that they lose their, I will call them their quantum property, the ones which are different than the classical properties. So in fact, it's not being small and big, which is the difference, it's being isolated and not. But historically, we've seen that it's easier to isolate systems which are small than big ones, so we call quantum systems small ones. But we might be able to see in the sky some quantum effects of something sometimes, which even on a large scale. In fact, I assume that you guys followed up the detection of the gravitational wave a couple of weeks ago. And in the LIGO, there is a piece which is really quantum mechanical. And I'm just going to leave this as a question mark. And at some point during the lectures, I'll try to come back. And if I haven't, by the end, week three, get back to me and I'll explain what's quantum mechanical about LIGO, which is very neat, by the way. Okay, so successes of quantum information science up to now. So I've already said that there are algorithms that we've discovered which are more efficient. We've developed a language to think about quantum mechanics in a slightly different way than what our friends in physics have been doing. And by this, and we'll see this a little bit more in detail, I call this the circuit model. So if I think about quantum mechanics, and you'll probably start to think about the Schrodinger equation, right? You have to say yes or no. So if I say quantum mechanics, what do you think about? Schrodinger equation, yeah, so good. So the circuit model, so if you solve the Schrodinger equation, you've probably start to think, okay, we'll make the approximation that the thing is time invariance or energy against state, you'll solve the square well or something like this and do things like this. When we do quantum information, we're really interested in the dynamic. And the computer scientists have these circuits where time goes like this way. And this is something you'll have to watch out. I thought the previous course is on quantum gravity. The quantum gravity people have time that goes up. Here we'll have time to go this way. And then we'll have the qubits, which goes this way. And then these lines are, let's say we have qubit 1, qubit 2, qubit 3. Think about three atoms. And then we're going to make operation on those. We're going to call them gates. And sometimes we talk only to this atom. So this is a gate. We have another gate here. And suddenly we have a gate which makes these two talk to each other in a certain way. So we have a circuit, which is this way, which describes the evolution of the quantum system. Of course, you can translate this back into the Schrodinger equation. But sometimes this diagram will help you to see what's happening and say make connection that you might not have done just by solving the Schrodinger equation. So this new language, I think, is very neat. So you thought you were coming to a physics course as some kind of social science course in the literature department that you're part of now. There's implication for the foundations of quantum mechanics, just rephrasing things in the terms of information. We've learned interesting thing about this. The beginning of development of technology, sensors, communication, computing. And we have demonstrated in the lab that this idea of quantum information processing is not totally crazy. So when I started to work in this field in the 1990s, there are people who would tell me, it is impossible to control the wave function of a quantum system. Now, you've gone kind of 20 years after when I started to do this, I couldn't really understand that people were thinking that because of the uncertainty principle, you couldn't really control quantum systems. And it turns out that the uncertainty principle doesn't stop you to controlling the wave function. In fact, when you solve the Schrodinger equation, that's exactly what you do, and you can have a physical system which make your wave function follow a very specific path. This is what these algorithms do. So we've learned this. And in doing this, we've learned how to make these transformations in a robust way. If there's noise around, we've learned how to kind of control this. And again, this is the work of quantum error correction. So we have had some success, but it's still a field which is very much in its infancy. We don't have a quantum computer yet. We have small processor up to dozens of quantum bits, and we try to get our impression of how they work. Okay, so this is number two. So now, yeah, you need to answer a few more questions from me. So you have to prepare yourself. Okay, background. So I need to understand a little bit some of your background so I don't go and say things that is way off. If I say polymatrices, sigma x, sigma y, sigma z, good. Yeah, the good reactions. I need to keep on. Tensor products, good. Partial trace. Hey, addition of angular momentum. Okay, who hasn't seen addition of angular momentum? So everybody is comfortable with this. And don't be shy, I can spend a little, we won't need to use this very much.
How much do we know about
this? Not that much. So, if I say you have two spin half particles, okay, and you have a spin half here, a spin half here, okay, and you want to say what is the total angular momentum of these two things?
Either spin zero.
That's it. So you add it, and if you have a spin one, and you add a spin half, what will you get?
Half to three.
That's it. So you're good. And then after spin three half, it's too complicated, so I'm going to stop there. Oh, I might use four spin at some point if things work. The harmonic oscillator. Yeah. You good? Now, you guys are going to have a laugh. There is a group in Canada called the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, and there's a program on quantum information. It brings the computer scientists and physicists who get together. The program is about 10 years old, and we meet every 6 months in some funky location in Canada or abroad, and we talk about quantum information. And so the physicists learn about algorithm, complexity theory, and all that stuff. And at some point, the computer scientist says, can we have a lecture on the harmonic oscillator? So we had Barry Sanders from Calgary, who gave a full lecture on the harmonic oscillator, and we said, but there's infinities there. What do you do with this? And they kind of got all puzzled about it. And physicists say, oh yeah, you just sweep them under the rug and you don't have to worry. So with the harmonic oscillator, creation and annihilation operators. Okay, so we'll need this on Wednesday and Thursday when we talk about optics. And again, stop me if at some point I say things which then is way up there. So first thing that we need to know from there. So fundamental, What is a qubit? But before mentioning what is a qubit, then I'm going to first start with what is a classical bit. So what is a classical bit? You can speak louder so I can hear. You said it. So.
0, 1,
okay.
So one,
it's, yeah, it's a 0, 1, but it's a unit of information. So you want to manipulate information, and you can do this in different ways. And I'm going to warn you, when I first learned that field of classical information, and I'm one of those who've learned a little bit more quantum information before learning classical information. So in fact, some people would say I've learned it from the more fundamental way, as classical is a limit of quantum. I was puzzled. When we hear information, I usually think about what I read on my sheet of paper, or when I read the newspaper or listen to the radio or something like this. This is information. But this notion of information depends a lot on you think it's good or bad information if you are one political party or the other political party. So mathematicians in the 30s and 40s, in particular Claude Shannon, defined information related to entropy, not to what we call the content of the information. So when we think about information, is sets of bits in given states. And there's a lot of information if you can put a lot of entropy in these sets of, in these physical systems. There's two ways of doing this, some with continuous state or some with discrete state. And people have learned that sometimes it's easier to do things in the physical world with continuous state in an analog way. That's why when you look at your car, if you have an old car, then the gas gauge would be a needle, which is a continuous value. But these things are not reliable if you try to scale them. We don't know how to make reliable analog information in a scalable way. But we know how to do this with digital systems. Okay, and we do this with classical error correction. And that's why you see more and more and more of these digital systems. And so from now on, I'll talk essentially nothing about analog classical systems. But they'll come back when we talk a little bit about error correction. So a classical bit is a basic unit of information encoded in a physical system which has two states. Okay, we call it 1, 0, and the other one, 1. And what we have in mind is that now we'll make a string of bits. And this is what your computer does. It has a bunch of little capacitance which get charged or discharged, all kind of in the memory. It's kind of a little magnetic moment which point up or point down. You have a string of them, and this is what you manipulate. There is something which is a little bit more general than these pure state classical bits. And they are called probabilistic bits. Okay. So these one can mean 0 or 1. But there is a probabilistic classical bit. It is one which can have a certain probability of being between 0 and 1. And the way I'm going to picture it is the 0, the 1 there, and the line in between. So if you're here, that means it's probability 1 minus p of being 0 and probability p of being 1. Okay. Then you can think about this as a density matrix 2 by 2, and then depending on what your diagonal terms are, then you are in here. So here we have a 2 by 2 matrix. This corner tells you if you're in 0 or 1, and here, so you'll have something here or something there. You have zeros over there. And here you can have your density matrix, which has 1 minus p, and p over there. Okay? So this is a little bit more general. But when you go and measure these bits, you'll measure that you're in 0, or you'll measure that you're in 1. Okay? A quantum bit. So what is a quantum bit? Maybe I should have said a classical bit is a physical system which can be encoded in two states. So a quantum bit, you can think is a quantum system And I'll do something a little bit more tricky. And you won't see this in the books I mentioned. It won't be defined that way, but it'll be a slightly more general. It's a quantum system whose observable are the Pauli matrices. One, X, Y, Z. Okay. Question of notation here. When I mention X, sometimes call this sigma X, right? So if I, in anybody's puzzle, if I write the Pauli matrices as one, X, Y, and Z, okay. Sometimes in the old books, it would be sigma X, sigma Y, sigma Z. So I'm going to just write them. At some point, I might write sigma, but not right, not to confuse you too much. So for example, an atom, which has two levels, okay? And you can state one, state zero and state one, have observable are that form, and then that's an example of quantum. Okay? A magnetic moment, if you look at the hydrogen atom, it has a little magnetic moment inside the nucleus. You can point up or down, but you get zero or one when you put a magnetic field. Again, you'll have two levels. So systems which have two levels are examples of quantum bits. There are systems which have, are bunched together, which you might not think about two level, but still obey, still have observable of that form. When we do quantum error correction, some of this happens. So that's why I make this definition a little bit more general. And, but most of the time, people think about qubits as a system which has have two levels. So a generic state here will be alpha 0 plus beta 1. Okay, and because we ask that this is being normalized, you have alpha squared plus beta squared is equal to 1. Okay, and there is a way of thinking about this, of these states, as being represented as the surface of a sphere. Okay. And this is called a Bloch sphere. So anybody has seen the Bloch sphere? Good. So then, if I'm just saying things you know, you can push me along and say, go faster. Don't be shy about it. So to be sure that, because this will come again, the North Pole is 0, the South Pole is 1. So in that picture, these states don't look orthogonal. But in the Hilbert space, 0 and 1 are orthogonal, right? The state here is 0 plus 1, which is really in the x direction. And it turns out that 0 plus 1, so now this is a little bit confusing. I put x here, which looks like this x. So what I mean here is that this is an eigenstate of this operator. And here you have 0 plus I1. And the back is 0 minus I1. And this one is 0 minus IY. In general, you have a state which goes there. This angle will be theta. And the angle in the XY plane, this is Y, this is Z, is phi. So we can write, we write this thing as cos theta of 0 plus sine theta e to the I phi 1. And so in that language, writing it this way, it's obvious that it is this point here. So we're going to use this again and again as your pictorial way of thinking about a qubit. These are pure states. So do you know what a pure state is and a mixed state is? Good. So a pure state is one where the trace of rho squared is equal to 1. And that corresponds to the surface of that sphere. And at some point, we'll encounter states which are mixed state. And from that picture, it corresponds to the states where are inside the Bloch sphere. And the state which is straight in the middle is the state rho, which is equal to 1 half. But in general, the state will be ax plus by plus cz. This is a generic one qubit state. And the A, B, and C are the components of that vector in that picture. Okay? Good. This is the state for one qubit. And if I give you many qubit, many hydrogen atoms next to each other, then it'll be a tensor product of each of those. And there are states which looks like classical bits. When in my matrix here, I have a pure state which is either 0 or 1, that will look like a classical bit. Sometimes it looks like a probabilistic classical bit. If the density matrix of this thing, if I write this as a 2x2 matrix, as only diagonal terms, that look like a probabilistic bit. But quite often, if you have some x and y components, you'll have some terms here, which usually you don't have in the classical form. Good. Questions? So now we have our quantum bits. The question is, what can we do with them? How can we manipulate them? Okay? So we can manipulate them with operations mu, which belong to I should have said here somewhere. That a qubit belongs to a complex plane in two dimension, okay, and then a set of n qubits is the tensor product of many of those. So now we want to look at unitary operations. We are going to transform these states to other states, or this density matrix to another density matrix. Just to be sure that we're on the same page, the unit matrix is 1, 0, the diagonal with 1. X, something that we'll call sigma x, is the off-diagonal term. Y is the imaginary part with a minus. And when I write y, you should always be on your guard, because sometimes I put the minus at the wrong place. So it's your task to keep me straight. I'll try hard to do it, because it helps you. But if at some point an equation doesn't work, check this. And then z is this. OK? And the way I remember this one, usually I have to go back and work that this is true for 2x2 Pauli matrices. So from this, I work around. And then there's a cyclic version of this. So from this, I can go and find out what y is. OK? So a generic unitary matrix, OK, for one qubit, can be thought as a rotation on this. So let's look at a simple example first. A rotation, let's say, around this axis. What we're going to do is transformation of that block sphere for one qubit, so which is a rotation of the block sphere. And so if you think about it in a general way, it's a rotation around an axis by a given angle. Okay, so let's think for a simple example, a rotation around of an angle phi over 2 around the z-axis. Okay. If you apply this to this state, alpha 0 plus beta 1, what you will see is that this gives you So, do I need to go into detail about this? Okay, so you've seen this. So it's a rotation around phi, and so you always have to watch your factors of 2 when you do these rotations. So it's a rotation of 5 of this element. So I can think about this block sphere as rotated around the z-axis, and then by this. Okay. So in general, a general rotation. Is given by e to the I theta over 2 n dot sigma. Now here's my sigma notation coming back because it's hard to have x, y, z with a little vector. And this means there's a vector n around that block sphere, which tells me something like a vector, let's call it something like this. N is determined by two numbers, again, similar to here, theta and phi. Where are this vector pointing? And I'm rotating by an angle of theta around this. And this is the most general transformation you can do on a qubit. Okay? You're going to need this from time to time. So I'm going to write in details how you can expand this. Okay, so now this you have 2x2 matrices, you can write this. So if I give you any state of this form, you can just multiply this matrix by this. And you remember, so let's call this U. So if I have U applies on psi, you'll get this. And if you have a density matrix, you have to remember that you have to find it doing U and U dagger. Now, any rotation can be done by this for one qubit. And then you can start to think about what kind of operation that you can do with two qubit. And we'll come back to some details of this a little bit later on. But the important point is that you can have the tensor product of all these U's, but there's also some U's, let's say if you have two qubits, which cannot be represented. Okay, I'll put those four. If you have two qubits, so it's a 4x4 Hilbert space, there are some that cannot be written of this form. So that you cannot get a state, the final state, by just rotating these two independently, but there has to be a gate between two of them. And we know, however, that they can be generated by adding a single gate to this ensemble that we have of the U's for each of the qubit. And so there is one gate that will come again, called the C0 gate, and as a 4x4 matrix. It looks like this, okay? And what does this C0 gate act on? Two qubits. The first one, we'll call it the target. First one we'll call it the control, and the second one we'll call it the target. And essentially what that gate does is if this one is zero, it does nothing to the second qubit. And if the control is one, it applies the X operator on the second qubit, it flips it. Okay, so you can look at your state. I give you a state, let's call it alpha 0,0, plus beta 0,1, plus gamma 1,0, plus delta 1,1. Okay, and then we'll call this U C0 on psi. And what are we going to get? Okay, somebody on the first turn, the first qubit is the control. Okay, second term?
0.01.
Third term? Third term, fourth term? Good. So it does this. In fact, there's a classical gate, which is the control knot too, but there's a quantum version of this. Now we'll come back a little bit later and to mention that if you have a control knot gate between any of the qubits, like qubit K and qubit L, we can do control knots between those. And you have a generic unitary transformation for each of the qubits individually. Then you can build any unitary. You give me a U, and I can decompose it in terms of this sampler operation. Okay? In fact, so I'm going to write this as a function of C naught, and then single qubits. Okay? And then single qubits, I'm thinking about U's that we've written at the top right over there, general rotation. But it turns out that you don't need all of them. If you just want a good approximation of any gate, you can reduce a general rotation by gates which are called ADAMR, okay, which is this, and something which is called a T gate, which has the form by using these two, you can combine them to approximate any general rotation. So now we have a discrete set of gates with which we can do things. And this is really good if you want to, for example, be an experimentalist, because you know that you need only a couple of knobs in your device to make a general transformation. You need to be able to do T gates, show that you can do NMR gates. You're able to do C naught, then you're good. It's called a universal set of gates. Okay, now
question. So the set of single qubit gates, is it infinite or finite?
Sorry?
So the single qubit gates, is that an infinite set of qubit of gates or?
So repeat this again.
Because you're saying that any unitary is C naught and single qubits.
Yep.
But the set of single qubit gates is infinite.
So the way I wrote it up, it's infinite. Then you would have to have infinite control if I give you one, if the theta has zillions of bits. But you can approximate any of those. So tell me which level of approximation that you want, epsilon. Okay? You can approximate any general rotation by using only two with an amount of resources which goes like the log of 1 over epsilon. So it's a fair approximation, doesn't take too much resources. And the fair amount of resources, this is something that's going to come back again and again. Okay, because the distinction between a quantum and classical computer is often related to the amount of resources that they take to solve certain problems. Okay, a few more minutes. So we have qubits, we have gates, 1-bit gates, 2-bit gates, so we can do algorithms with them. Somebody has done this algorithm, you need to poke out the answer out of it, so we need to do a measurement. So you're familiar that in quantum mechanics, the probability is proportional to the amplitude square, which is called Born's rule. So if you have a state which is of this form, then you do a measurement, and we'll say that this x is what we call the computational basis, which we'll assume that it is these zeros and one. We could go in different bases. So I'll come back to this computational basis in a second. So if this is the computational basis, you're going to make a measurement, and then you'll get a probability, PR of x, which is equal to ax squared. Okay? And you can do this for the whole state, but you can also make partial measurements. Suppose that this degree of freedom is only one of the degrees of freedom of your quantum system. So you would have a wave function, for example, which will be sum over x, ax, psi over x. Okay? And then you can go and measure this only. And then so if you measure this in this part, what comes back is just a number, and you're in that eigenstate. If you measure here, then what you'll get is with probability ax squared, you'll end up with a state x psi of x. So the second system will be determined by measuring the first one. And we're going to use this again a little bit later. Okay. You've seen this in all courses of quantum mechanics as one of the assumptions of quantum mechanics, that the probability is proportional to psi squared. And this is called Born's rule. Right? So I'm going to go back to you. Your profs in the past years as an undergrad has told you this. Have you ever wondered, is this true? How do we know? How would you know that it's really psi squared? That's good. So, double slit experiment. You send some, in fact, we should say, if you can prepare states and you can measure them, you can go and test that. Double slit experiments is one of those. You get this, and then you get some interference pattern, which is something like this. And this thing comes in from psi. You go and measure, or psi of x, where your x is this way. You go and measure this with your photon detector, and you should go and get this. Now, there's theories of quantum gravities that kind of claim that maybe quantum gravity would modify the square and go and measure. You get some other little perturbation there. So there's some work by Raphael Sorkin, who is here at PI, who's been interested in this. And some years ago, I got really interested in this and some funny coincidence of having a postdoc who was building a single photon source. And I wanted to have a single photon source so I can do some outreach with it, that people would come in the lab and they would see single photon interference out of the two slit. So you remember the two slit is, okay, you block this, you get something, a pattern. Like this. If you block that one, if you block the other one, you get the same pattern, whether it just kind of displaced. I'm sorry, my drawing skills are not that great, but you get different pattern. And then you might say, if I open both, do you get the sum of these two? And you know, if you've done quantum mechanics, it is not. That this, the blue one, is, if we call this A and B, it's psi of A squared. The green one is psi b squared, but this piece is psi a plus psi b squared, which is equal to psi a squared plus psi b squared plus twice psi a plus psi a psi b star plus psi a star psi b, right? And these terms is what gives you this. And because you have complex numbers in there, you have something that can subtract. And this is part of quantum mechanics of why it is different. Now, the postdoc was interested in looking at the using the source. And he says, oh, there's an experiment with three slits that might be interesting. So I said, what is it? And he couldn't really say too many things about it, but he says, I heard this in the grapevine, and maybe we should look into it. I said, great. That afternoon, I came here to Parameter. And then I met Faye Dauker and Raphael Sorkin, and they asked me what I was doing. And for some reason, I said, oh, we're having the single photon source, and my postdoc is talking about the three-slit interference. And they both started laughing. I said, hey, stop laughing at me. And Faye said, oh, it's Raphael who has this idea. And I said, great, so you can explain to me. So there's a neat experiment where you can have a third slit. And I should point out that we did the experiments in 2010 or 11. I thought the two-slit experiments has been there for 100 years. Or the first one was done in 1806, so I don't think there would be anything new. And in fact, people had done some three-slit experiments, but never that one. It was an experiment indeed to test the square there. Okay? So maybe I'm going to write just at the bottom. So if you have a three-slit experiment, a three-slit, and you open the three of them, you have a probability PABC, which is PA plus PB plus PC. Okay? And if you write this at length, because you have a square here, you'll get that this is equal to PAB plus PAC plus PBC minus PA minus PB minus PC. Okay? So just expand these three things and just recombine the terms and then just put this all together. And once you see this, it tells you you can do a neat experiment to test if you have a square. You do the experiments where the three slits are open. And you go and measure what does the detector look there. And you could do it at many points. Then you do the same experiment where you close C. And you do the same thing. You do the same thing, close B, close A. And then you close two of them, maybe the three combination, and all of this. So you need to find is epsilon some quantity, which is PABC minus PAB minus C minus AC plus PA plus PB plus PC. Is this equal to zero? And if it is equal to zero, well, you've tested that. And if it's not equal to zero, then you've shown that there's some really neat effects, which would be great if we would have found that quantum mechanics would not be obeyed. So that would be. Now, a little curious thing, and I see we've run out of time. So anybody wants to get out, you can. We didn't get zero. Damn it. Is this experimentalist only if there are things right? So the first thing that we realize is detectors are not perfect. They have something called dark counts. They count things even if this is all closed. They still count something because the internal functioning, you can have excitation and things like that. If you look at the dark count of this, so the dark count of this would cancel with those one, and this one with this one, and this one with this one. But this one has nothing to be canceled. So we had to add minus P0. You have to cancel those ones. The second thing is that I told you that you do this with closing these things. But all the other variables have to be exactly the same thing, like the number of photons that I've gone through initially. And this is really hard. We don't have a deterministic source of photons, so it was really hard to do this. And there's the stability of the interferometer to do this also. That kind of makes a difference. So at the end, we got something which was not zero, small, but we could explain from a lot of difference. OK, so what we've done today? I gave you a motivation of why quantum information is interesting. And then I started to go into the details of what is a qubit, what kind of gate we do, what kind of measurement that we do. And then I had a little distraction on recent experiments, kind of testing one fundamental principle of quantum mechanics. Thank you, and see you tomorrow.